can be proven. But that's not really it at all. I mean, faith is, we have faith in things that are proven, that are consistent, that are trustworthy. It's not something blind. It's not something that is baseless, but it has a very strong foundation. And Joshua reminds them of that. Yeah, and we can have that faith again because he's proven himself over and over. God has proven himself. If you go down to verse 6, it says, "Be very firm then to keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, so that you may not turn aside from it to the right hand or to the left." I would say this is basically the secondary point in this message. The main point is keep God first. You know, your focus and your only focus is God. And then kind of because of that, do what he says. So it's not just that I'm with God because I'm not with these people. But if I'm with God, I'm going to do what God says. I'm going to keep his word. I'm not going to stray from it. And so in doing that, the main kind of emphasis he points out here in verse 7 is that you don't associate with these nations which remain among you. Don't mention the names of their gods. Don't serve them or bow down to them. So not only is it don't go after these gods, but you really need to stay away from these people because they're going to lead you to their gods if you allow them, if you associate with them and leave them. And I like how he says it in verse 8, cling to the Lord your God. You know, hold tight to him. Again, it's not just an idea of, well, there's two people on opposite sides and I'm just going to kind of get closer to this one. But it's really the idea you think of with a small child. When they're scared, what do? They run. They'll grab a hold of their parents. They'll like wrap themselves around their leg or, depending on their size. That's kind of the image I see here that God is telling these people to have and really telling us to have, is that trust that the little child has in their parents. And it makes sense. That's an analogy that's used quite often through the Bible, is the relationship between God and his children, God and us. He goes on to explain in verse 9, "The Lord has driven out great and strong nations from before you. As for you, no man has stood before you. One of your men puts to flight 1,000, for the Lord your God is he who fights for you, just as he promised. So take diligent heed to yourselves to love the Lord your God." Again, he doesn't hit exactly specifics here, but he basically tells them there are these great nations that you have driven out, but that God has driven out for you, essentially. He says, one of your men puts to flight 1,000 because God fights for you. And so he emphasizes here, and again, he's going to continue to emphasize, that their successes here, their victories, their wins in battle, were not because of their might, but they were because God was fighting for them. And later he's going to go on to say, basically, you didn't do anything and you were given these great gifts. And we'll look at that in a minute. But verse 12, I think, is, again, kind of this big challenge. He tells them, if you ever go back and cling to the rest of these nations, these which remain among you, and intermarry with them, so that you associate with them and they with you, know for certain that the Lord your God will not continue to drive these nations out from before you. But they will be a snare and a trap to you and a whip on your sides and thorns in your eyes until you perish from off the good land which the Lord your God has given you. So I think it's important to look at here. We have to remember that they were commanded to drive out all the people, all the inhabitants of the land. And when we looked through the division of the land, we saw that they'd taken over a lot of the land, but there were some pockets still left. There were some inhabitants of the land that they had not driven out yet. But God tells them, you know, go ahead and divide up the land. Go ahead and take your inheritance, but continue to drive them out. And that's important to recognize, as that was still their responsibility or their requirement. And God emphasizes throughout this book and even leading up to it that he's going to drive these people out. You know, through them, he's going to make sure it happens. But he basically gives them one stipulation that if they don't meet it, he's not going to support them. He's not going to drive them out. What's that stipulation? What's that?
Serve him.
Yeah, serve him, but specifically, what can they not do? Yeah, don't associate yourself, don't connect yourself with these people. And really, that completely makes sense, because if the people are associating themselves or connecting themselves with the people of the land, they are basically inviting the people to stay. They're saying, we want you here in doing that. We want you to stay with us. And so, I mean, that's a complete rebellion against God. And so it's not, and I'm not saying this is what they could have done, but it's not just that they were too lazy to do it. You know, it's not just if you don't put forth the energy to drive them out, but it's even more extreme than that. And we're going to see this is what they do. You know, it's not that they didn't go through and carry it out, but they completely rebelled against. They went the other direction and they clung to the people of the land. You know, God said, cling to me, but instead they clung to, or they associated with, those who were in the land. And that's when God says, I'm not going to drive them out if you do this. And sadly, we're going to see the rest of the Old Testament is riddled with problems because they did cling to these people. James?
In other words, to me, I don't know about this, sort of reminds me actually of the United States, you know, all the nations and things like that. And what the United States is really not doing is clinging to God like it's supposed to. So he's not going to drive these people out. So these people are actually going to take over this land, believe it or not, and it's going to become a communist territory. That's my feeling, you know. So this actually, that's what reading this, what you read in 13, reminds me of that situation.
Yeah, and I think the one big difference between really this and any nation now is that this nation was God's chosen nation. God had decided, these are my people. And while we should hope that our nation and that all the nations around the world want to cling to God, want to respect him, he had an even more special relationship, a extremely special relationship with this people, in that they were a nation not only geographically, or not only like with their leadership, but they were a nation religiously as well, so politically and religiously. So they had this even greater connection than God to God than the nations today really can have. But the point is the same, in that at least, and what we're going to see, and I think the end of this chapter, or the next chapter, is going to sum it up, is that, you know, Joshua has been a great leader of these people, but he's going to say, you know, you got to decide for yourself. It's an individual thing, what you end up doing.
Clark,
yep.
One thing that I kind of look at this and look at it today, and it's when we decide to become a Christian, we can't have any remnant of that old life in there, because if we leave it there, it's going to creep in. If we try to continue to associate with a lot of the, maybe it's the people or the lifestyles that separated us from God at that time, he's not going to be there with us. We're going to end up being weak and following along with them. So what Joshua is telling the people here is, as Christians, we need to look at that as how we need to live our lives. You know, not clinging to the past, not clinging to the old ways. But if we want God to remain steadfast in our lives, we have to remain steadfast in his word. We have to leave those things behind, not cling to them, not get out and intermingle with things. I'm not saying that we marry, but when we get out and we start dabbling in other things that we know are maybe borderline, that can lead us away. So to me, I think that this message that he's given the people, we today can look at that message, and that's the same message that we need to understand too, as being Christians, that we can't have a toe in the water over here, because, you know, when you put your toe in the water, it changes the temperature of the whole body, and that, you know, once we get our toe into it, it can take us totally away.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, we really do have basically the same charge here that they have. You know, cling to God and don't kind of be back and forth, or don't cling to anything else. And there's so many things we can cling to. We can cling to money. We can cling to our family. We can cling to our jobs, or to our physical goods. Or there's so many things that we can cling to. And if I put all my trust in my family, you know, it's good to take care of your family, and it's good to have a good relationship to your family. But if your trust is in your family, or is even in something that we would typically consider a good thing, but it's not in God, then even that's going to be absent of what God wants us to do. In the last part of chapter 23, he kind of gets harsh with them a little bit in this reminder. He says basically, the middle of 14, not one word of all the good words which the Lord your God spoke concerning you has failed. All have been fulfilled. Not one of them has failed. It shall come about that just as all the good words which the Lord your God spoke to you have come upon you, so the Lord will bring upon you all the threats until he has destroyed you from off this good land which the Lord your God has given you when you transgress the covenant of the Lord your God which he commanded you and go serve other gods and bow down to them. Then the anger of the Lord will burn against you and you will perish quickly from off the good land which he has given you. This really reminds me back to the command in Deuteronomy and then what happened after they entered the land where Joshua got up there and they split the people onto the two mountains, onto Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And the reminder, the blessings on Gerizim, if you do what God says, then good things will happen. He will do good to you. But if you rebel against him, if you disobey him, if you go on Mount Ebal, was the curses, that you will be cursed. You will have these problems. And so he again is just kind of re-emphasizing that point. And before we move on from this chapter, I just want to say, if anything was ever told to me that it's going to be like thorns in my eyes, I am going to do everything I possibly can to stay away from that. I'm really sensitive about my eyes, and the thought of thorns in my eyes, like, I can hardly keep my eyes open when I say that. And that's the, like, that type of imagery is to express the significance of what these dangers are, the significance of the problems that if we, like Doug said, if we cling to what's in the world or what's away from God, that's what the problems are going to be like to us. And at least to me, that imagery really stands out to me because of just the agony that sounds like it would be to me. Does anyone have any other thoughts on this chapter before we go to chapter 24?
I think verse 6, be very strong, be careful to obey all that is written in the book of the law of Moses. That is where Joshua told them that, to remember that. And then he goes on down to the end and tells them what's going to happen to them if they do not.
Yep. And we're going to see at the end of chapter 24 when they get weak, and it's going to be basically when this group has forgotten, when they've moved on. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah, it was a challenge, but God had shown them he was going to take care of everything they needed. And again, we'll see at the end of chapter 24 that kind of once you get a little bit removed from seeing these things, from being a part of it, is when the trouble comes. Sometimes it's a lot quicker than that, like with the Exodus, but we'll see that. 24, he starts off kind of recounting their history. Now, typically, when Israel's history is recounted, who's it started with? Who's the main person they go back to? Well, Moses would be probably the second one, but even more than that, they go back to Abraham. This one doesn't go back to Abraham. This one goes back one step further. Where does this one go back to? Yeah, it goes back before Abraham to Terah, his father. Interesting, but I think we'll see why he does this. What does he say about Terah and those people? Yeah, the one description we have of them here is they served other gods, or they were idolaters. And that's going to be important when he's going to kind of drive home his message at the end. But then he kind of is going to go through the history. He goes through Abraham. He talks about Isaac. He talks about Jacob and Esau. And he says to Esau, I gave Mount Seir. But to Jacob, his sons went down to Egypt. And then he says he sent Moses and Aaron. And he reminds them of the plagues. He reminds them of the darkness that separated them from the Egyptians and the sea crashing down on the Egyptians. And then he tells them he brought them into the land. He brought them across the Jordan. He talks about Balaam. Balaam gets brought up a lot, probably more than most what would seem like minor characters. He brings up Balaam to remind them, you know, even when this person tried to curse you, he wanted to curse you. He did everything he could to curse you. I wouldn't let him. I made him bless you. So he reminds them of that. He reminds them of the kings that they defeated, the people that they defeated. Again, verse 12, he says, then I sent the hornet before you, and it drove out the two kings of the Amorites from before you, but not by your sword or your bow. Again, this is an image that frightens me as well. Wasps scare me. I don't like them. When I was in school, I was reading this and teaching a lesson on this, and I'd been stung like 6 months earlier, and I still had a mark on it. I've still got a little mark on it where I got stung by a wasp. I just don't like them. A hornet or hornets would be significantly worse than that. It's hard to say here if this is literally hornets or if it's just a representation of the terror that I would feel if hornets were coming at me. I think either one is possible. But again, that picture of, you know, look at what I did to these kings. I drove them out with the hornet or with this terror. And we saw the terror that the people had toward God. We saw that their hearts melted in Jericho. They talked about that. So he reminds them of all these things he's done to put them in the position that they're in right now. And then he goes on to remind them what he's given them in verse 13. He says, I gave you a land on which you had not labored, cities which you had not built. You have lived in them. You are eating of vineyards and olive groves, which you did not plant. So we talked about the Israelites were required to do a lot of things. They were commanded to drive out the people, to obey God. But he reminds them that you've been given a lot. You know, I've given you all these things that you didn't work for. So whatever work they would have done, it would not have risen to the level of them saying that we had built these cities or we had planted these olive gardens and vineyards or lived in these houses or cities. So he reminds them again of all that he's done for them, or Joshua reminds them of all that God has done for them. And so again, I always have enjoyed the biblical histories because that's kind of like the background. That's like a Bible lesson, how they used what had happened before that to make a point. And it's kind of a good example, I think, to anyone who teaches or preaches to look at how those in the Bible did it, used history or used lessons to emphasize significant points. But he reminds them of all these things that God has done. God has proven himself over and over and over and over again to put you in this great situation that you're in. And I think this is the best situation Abraham and his descendants have ever really been in. They finally have the land that was promised to them. And this is a land that was described as flowing with milk and honey. It's the promised land. It's as ideal a place as could be described in this world. And so he has reminded them of that, and he set them up for that. And then Joshua gives them a great challenge. Starting in verse 14, he says, now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. If it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourself today whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served, which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Such a powerful statement, such a powerful assertion. But it's also a very powerful and challenging question or challenge he puts forth to them. And he reminds them, and I think that's kind of why he had established this history, is he reminds them that idolatry has not been far from them. They came out of an idolatrous family. I think that's why he starts with Terah and those people were idolatrous. He says, you could go back to that. You could go back to what your forefathers, you know, and they always, like we said, want to point back to Abraham. But if they wanted to, they could point back to Terah and say, no, we're going back to our father and serving these other gods. Or he reminds them, you saw the gods that were served in Egypt, but you saw the plagues that really outdid those gods. And then he says, you're also going into a land that has been filled with idolatry. So there has been idolatry. There has been the serving of false gods all throughout their history. It's not been far off from them. And so he tells them, you know, you can go back to that. You know, that's possible. You've seen it. You know what it's like. Or you can serve God. And I've just shown you what God has done. I've just reminded you of what God has done for you. You know, what did those gods, how did those gods protect the Egyptians?
They did not.
Not at all. You know, remember these plagues, see what happened. Their gods couldn't stop it. But what has your God given you? He's given you these cities. He's given you these vineyards. He's given you these homes. He's given you these victories. And so his challenge is choose today whom you will serve. You know, this is a decision that can't be put off because then you're going to slide away. But choose today whom you will serve.
And then shows them every aspect of the gods, mm-hmm. how they came through, and they could none of them ever stand to God. So he's laying it out there for you, and just like we have today, we can choose to serve that which leads to righteousness, which leads to a place in heaven, or we can serve the world and the worldly things of it and die a horrible death. And that's basically what he's telling them right there.
Yeah, and he says, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Joshua, to me, has been a great leader. I would consider him one of the greatest leaders in the history of the world. But he says, you know, I can't choose who you're going to serve. He says, I have some influence over my house or my family. My house, I have set up, I have built my household around serving God. And so I think to a great extent, we have great influence and the ability to emphasize that in our families. But as the leader of this people, he could not control who they were going to serve. He could not control what they were going to do. But he challenges them. And so what's their response? What do they say they're going to do? We are going to follow God. They say, far be it from us, or there's no way we're going after these other gods. We will do what we are supposed to do. We have seen what he did. Verse 18, the Lord drove out from before all the people, from before us all the people, even the Amorites who lived in the land. We also will serve the Lord, for he is our God. So, good answer. The right answer. What does Joshua then say to them?
Cannot serve, for he is the holy God.
Yeah, he says, you're not going to be able to. I don't think he's saying that to say it's impossible. There's no chance you all are going to do this. But I think he's just emphasizing that it is going to be challenging.
I think he's saying it because of where they've been and what they've done. So now they're switching over and they're still going to have that temptation problem. So I think that's why he said that.
Yeah. And how does he describe God?
A jealous
God. And it says he will not forgive your transgressions or your sins. Again, that's not an absolute statement in the sense that we know God is a forgiving God. We know that God, that all have sinned. So if God didn't forgive sins, then he would have no people. But again, just the emphasis that this is a challenge. You can't just go out and do whatever you want to do. You can't just go, and especially the jealous part here, go to these other gods. You can't mix both worlds, essentially.
It's going to be difficult. It's not going to be easy. They're going to have to work it.
And I sometimes wonder, and I go back and forth on this, I wonder if this is something that we should remind people who are ready to become Christians, to remind them that this is what you need to do, this is absolutely crucial to you, but it's not going to be easy. You know, it's not just you've made this decision, we've made this statement, we will serve God, the same decision that Christians make today. But it's not just making that and quitting. You can't just say that and then be done. But it's going to be a challenging work because God is jealous and because God is very demanding of us clinging to Him, following Him and not following other gods or following the world. So He challenges them that, and He says what's going to happen if they forsake God. And what's he say is going to happen to them if they turn from what's right? He'll destroy them or he'll consume them. Yeah, I mean, it's important. And that's why Joshua's getting ready to go on. This is, again, probably his final day of life, maybe. And he's telling them, you know, I'm going on, but that doesn't mean this commitment has to change. It doesn't mean it's allowed to change. But what's their response to it? They respond again, no, we will serve the Lord. So... yeah, James, go ahead.
This is a guide. I mean, this also goes for us. Like you said, you know, reading this story, reading this Bible, you know, it's not just for them people in that day. It's for us, too. Like I said, I'll destroy you. You know, I'll do what I say. I'm going to destroy all of us. You know what I mean? And there's a lot of people out there right now that they can change, but do they want to change? And so, you know, this is what it tells me, you know, because I haven't always been a good person, like I said, but I can say for the last 7 years I have been. So God is going to destroy a lot of us. So that's how I feel.
That's a big challenge, and it's got big consequences one way or the other. And again, it goes back to, I think it always kind of goes back to those mountains. If you do what God says, you're blessed, and if you don't, you're cursed. Real quickly going forward. Oh, yep. I'm almost there. Maybe you can just make the announcement, like. So he goes on, and he says, what they've said, or that they are witnesses against themselves, says, and they say, yes, we are witnesses. And so then what does he go on and do? Yeah, and then he makes a covenant. He makes a statute and an ordinance. He writes these things in the book of the law, and he takes a large stone and sets it up by the sanctuary of the Lord. And again, this stone or this memorial, he says, let it be a witness against us, for it has heard all the words of the Lord which he spoke to us. Thus it shall be for a witness against you, so that you do not deny your God. The last thing I want to touch on in Joshua is just a reminder of all the reminders that were in Joshua. Just quickly, what are some of the reminders or memorials or witnesses that we've seen in this book?
When they crossed the Jordan, they set up.
All right. They set up stones.
Maybe some in it, and maybe some.
At least one, maybe two memorials with crossing the Jordan.
There was also the big one on the east foot on the east.
Ed.
If you go back and look, it says it in there.
Or the witness in chapter 22, between the two groups. What else? I think those are great witnesses or reminders, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. What else? Go ahead.
The witness of the Lord when they were in battle, he told them, he said, lead them out, the other group get behind them.
Mm-hmm.
What was it, that guy?
Yeah, the winds that they saw there. We saw with the loss in Ai, the memorial or the reminder of Achan, the stones over Achan, a reminder of that. We see Jericho, the city is basically a reminder or a memorial, which is why they couldn't take anything from it. It was under the ban. It was a reminder of God's giving them the victory. And then we look at some of the events. We looked that before they crossed, they took the Passover. They remembered the Passover. which is a memorial. They observed the covenant requirement of circumcision, a reminder of that covenant. And we see here, he says, they're witnesses against themselves. He says he sets up a witness here. I'm sure there's more, but God made an effort to remind the people of the significance of remembering these things. And that's what we talked about. These things can be forgotten if they're not taught, but they were set up as a reminder. Just like the Lord's Supper for us. So we're going to see Joshua dies and is buried. We see they bury the bones of Joshua, which goes all the way back to really Genesis and or in Exodus. And we see that Eleazar dies. We see, though, that the people were faithful for one more generation. Verse 31 says, Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua and had known all the deeds which the Lord had done in Israel. So, again, it ends on a positive note. Not only Joshua, but those who had seen what had been done. Moving forward, it kind of gets to the sad part that right when you get past that group, it goes to naught. But let's just remember this as a reminder of the good things that God does. He emphasizes that they are blessed when they keep His word, when they do what He commands. And let's remember this for the positive nature of seeing that in action and recognizing that we will be blessed when we keep God's commands. Does anyone have any other thoughts before we close? All right, thank you all, and I don't know what we'll do next week, but we'll be told.
Who are you?